that is what you call a head of lettuce right there. I haven't gotten official scale measurement, which is that right there weighs close to about 2 pounds.
Yeah, I got some out there that's pretty light too. Now I'm becoming a big fan of this romaine.
Yeah, I ain't so sure you got some that nice, but you might have some close to it.
We'll see.
The trick is when it gets this time of year, keep the water to this stuff. It will bolt on you.
Yep.
Keep the water to it, and it's starting to get a nice little head there on it. You could make you one of those wedge salads if you wanted to. But this is some good stuff right there. It's almost getting too big to fit in a bag. I usually pull off some of these side leaves to get a little dirty from splashing dirt on.
You know, that's something I should have touched on the other day when we was talking about this. What I like about the romaines is it's a lot cleaner. Now, the sky posts, some of these other lettuces are great, but this has got this upright habit that grows upwards, and it's a lot cleaner than those other varieties. And that's one reason I like it. Also, you don't seem to get as much disease and leaf spot on the bottom leaves.
Yeah, because they're not touching the ground as much.
Yep. Rhizoctonia doesn't seem to be as bad in the crown rot because they have more airflow underneath them than some of the other varieties.
That's nice, green, nutritious there. Let's say hey to everybody.
Hello.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Row by Row Garden Show. We've got a great show planned for you tonight. Thanks for joining us. I'm Travis.
And I'm Greg.
And super excited to have you with us. We're going to talk a little bit about organic and conventional garden later on tonight. But right now, we're just having a little show and tell, talking about what's going on in our gardens. So we got our romaine lettuce here. And if you want to put that aside, I figured we'd partake in a little BLT. Now, BLT don't say nothing about bread. It says bacon, lettuce, tomato. And I'm still on this keto thing, which is going pretty good. I'm down about 20 pounds.
Really?
Down to about 190, back to my college weight.
Yeah.
So I'm a pretty bad dude right now.
Hey, don't mess with you, huh?
I put in about 6 miles on Saturday. Felt pretty good after that. So we got our lettuce here. Now, on the keto diet, we can have mayonnaise.
You can
have mayonnaise. There ain't no carbs in mayonnaise.
That may be up for it. Maybe this.
Now, this ain't Duke's. This is some off-brand mayonnaise. Bit of work for what we got. Yeah. So we're going to put us a little.
Because I love me some mayonnaise.
Tell me when now.
When.
Okay. And then I'm going to put me a little bit on there, too. And then we got us some mater here. Now, this is store-bought mater because we ain't got any maters ready
yet.
It ain't going to be long. So go and get you several pieces of the mater there. Don't take them all.
I got them.
And then I got
You've already salt and peppered them.
I did. And then we got some bacon there. We're going to kind of sprinkle in there.
I'm getting all excited here. All right.
Go and get the rest of that bacon in.
Ooh, can't have too much bacon.
No, you can't. That's some like, good, thick bacon, too.
All right.
All right, then we just...
You roll it this way?
Whichever way you can get a hold to it good. Yeah. And then...
Chomp on it. Not only is it good to you, it's good for you.
And it's pretty good without the bread.
It is.
Good mayonnaise makes it. And good bacon.
Yeah, I'm a little fond of the Duke's.
If only we had some old Tom Matthews bacon.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. That'll work right now.
Yep. We can make it. We need to move on.
Yeah.
We can stay.
We're liable to get hung up right there
big time.
All right. If you haven't tried that, folks, that's a good way to go right there.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about what else is going on in the garden.
Man, I got stuff growing left and right. If I make as many potatoes as I've made vine, I'm going to have to get my dump truck out there and haul them out of there. I have got some of the prettiest potatoes.
Now, you always say we ain't growing the potato plants.
I know, but I got some of the prettiest potatoes I've ever had. The jury's still out whether I'm going to have a good potato crop or not. I don't know, but I have got some pretty potatoes. Watermelons are starting to run. Tomatoes are growing leaps and bounds. Corn, we got a rain Sunday. Corn is greened up. You can hear it growing. It's growing so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Peas is growing, and everything is looking good. It's that time of the year I really enjoy. However, for us, this is that time of the year. It's real easy to lose that battle with the weeds. This is the time
to pop up.
This is the time when you got everything planted and everything's starting to go, and those weeds can get ahead of you. And this is the crucial time to keep everything cultivated and wheel hoed to keep it under control. Because if you lose the battle early, later on you can forget it.
Do it at least once a week and every time after it rains, and you'll be good shape. I noticed a couple pig weeds popping up the other day coming up. You talked about the potatoes. We had that rain this weekend, and then we've had a couple cool nights, which I really needed, because last week before that rain come, it was hot and we get a little bit of wind there, and I could tell my potato plants were suffering. The dirt wasn't necessarily dry, but those plants were, and I had to run overhead sprinkler just to kind of cool my plants off a little bit, because they were suffering in some of that 85 degree weather.
Yeah, I think that's going to be good for our potatoes to slow it down just a little bit.
So the cool nights was nice, and you know, we like our drip. Every now and then I will do a little overhead to cool something off if I need to.
Yep.
We had a video last week on planting okra.
While you were talking, I'm gonna be eating.
Go for it. And we have been selling the fire out of some okra seed. Everybody's been real excited about you trying the jambalaya and the red burgundy okra. And if you still haven't gotten okra seed, we still got plenty of it. Really good stuff if you've never tried those two varieties.
My red onions are coming along, not as big as what I want to be yet, because they ain't quite ready to pull. And I always grow a few of these, but I prefer my white onions. But my red onions is coming along pretty good.
Mm-hmm. My Texas Legends, the stems on them are getting a little soft. It could be any day now. I'll walk outside and these five or six of them fell over.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be long on them. I've still been putting the water to them heavy.
Oh, our buddy Chad said he couldn't stand them, or he had to pull his.
Really?
Yep.
I saw where old Gary in Florida is on Row by Row group. He's pulled his.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to wait till mine fall over.
Yeah, I think I got another week, 10 days.
When mine fall over, as long as it's nice if when they start falling over, you ain't got any rain in the forecast for 3 or 4 days, because you can just, I'll pull them up and leave them right there.
Yep.
And then about 3 days later, come and put them all underneath the barn.
I've got to build me a rack. Now, I got to get on that pretty quick. I got to build me a rack like you've got.
I got a good floor plan.
I got to do that. I was under instructions to do that pretty quick.
Miss Hoss?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She laid it out there on me.
Uh-oh. You better tighten up this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We also got a video. I got my winter squash planted, and I got a video coming out on that next week. And so I planted one of my 30 by 35 spots. I planted half of it in this kabocha and half of it in this spaghetti squash. And I want to talk about seed germination just a minute. So this says on the back of these packets 95%. Now, we don't test these. They get tested by the state. But I will tell you that I planted 4 rows of each of these, 30-foot rows, and I put a seed every foot. So I basically used 4 packets of this and 4 packets of this. With the kabocha, I didn't have not a single seed not come up.
You got 100%.
100%. And that's on 4 packets. That's a decent sample size. So 120 seeds. And then on this, I had 1 seed not come up. Now, I'm going to thin those out to 2 foot, but I just thought it was interesting. A lot of times this germ rate here, what you'll actually get is a little higher. We just have to go with what the lab tells us. But really proud of the germination we got on both of these.
I got my blue bayous planted and they're coming up.
How's your Cherokee tans looking?
Cherokee tans are looking good. We started them in the greenhouse because the seeds were precious to us. We didn't have many.
Right.
I transplanted them out there. I actually got them on drip, shoot a little water to them. And they looking pretty good. They're not running yet, but they're fixing to take off and start running.
I got zinnias planted a couple days ago.
Me too.
I kind of went against your idea of the color scheme. So I did one double row, but half the double row I did in the mix. And the other half, on one side I did lime, one side I did white.
Okay.
I know you like, you said you,
no, I just, solid. No, I can tell you from past experience years, when you block colors the same color, it's more appeasing to the eye. Now, if you're doing it for cut flowers, it doesn't matter.
What's more appeasing to the bee, though?
The bee don't care.
Okay.
And if you're doing it for cut flowers, it doesn't matter anyway, because you're going to mix them up. I'm just saying, if you're doing it for, in a landscape type situation, anytime you use colors, if you use block colors of one particular color, it makes it more appealing to the eye and a bigger show than you do if you mix that. You mix those colors up there, it's confusing to the eye.
I got you. I got you.
Yeah, write that down somewhere.
Write that down. That's good stuff. Okay, so before we get into today's main topic, which is a really good one, I do want to recap on the giveaway we got coming up in a few weeks. So this is episode 50.
50.
And big 50th yeah. episode.
Yep.
Halfway to 100. And on episode 52, our 1 year, we're going to do just give away a bunch of stuff. And the way you get entered is for each of these videos leading up to the 52nd one, you can comment on YouTube. You can share the video on Facebook, or you can comment on Facebook. So you can have an entry every week, basically, if you comment.
And we're going to draw
every week. You can only obtain one entry per week, but you can get multiple entries each week. And we're going to have a hat full of the names, and we're going to draw them out and give away some nice garden tools, seeds, all kind of good stuff.
Yep.
So get participated in that. Now, this week's topic, we're talking about organic and conventional garden, kind of pairing them against one another or comparing them. So there's this Forbes article, and it's actually an article from 2016. And I had read it a while ago, several years ago when it came out, but it just kind of started recirculating around on Facebook, and a lot of people I know that are involved in conventional farming were sharing it. And when I see people blindly sharing stuff without really knowing what they're supporting or stuff, it kind of, you know, puts a twinkle in my eye and makes me want to
straighten them out.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's hereditary. I got a little bit of the same thing.
So we'll put a screenshot of this article up here, and on YouTube we'll put a link to it in the description. You can check it out. So this is a guy, he pretty educated guy, wrote this article. Has worked in conventional farming for a long time,
and he's worked for DuPont,
right?
Disclosure there.
And the name of the article is Why I Don't Buy Organic and Why You Might Not Want to Either. And so he makes four or five really important points in his article, and we kind of just want to go through those and kind of say, well, that might not be necessarily always the case.
Now, this is a passionate subject on both sides, from the organic people and from the conventional people. It's a very passionate argument, and sometimes facts mistruths get placed in there when somebody's trying to make an argument. And that's what we're going to try to do today, is try to take the mistruths out of there. And you know what? Facts are facts, and that's, we can't make them anything but that. And that's the way we look at things, is factual. And we're going to try to disseminate a little bit of the talking points away from this article, And tell the truth, and maybe touch on the other side too. And they got some talking points that's not necessarily always truthful too. So one of these people that shared this article on Facebook, they titled it Make Informed Decisions. And I thought that was a great title on that, because that is, in the end of the day, that's what you want to do, is make informed decisions. Just because somebody writes an article for a media outlet like Forbes, which we think should have been vetted and should have been really looked at
right
under a microscope to make sure it was all factual, doesn't necessarily mean so. And we can see this article right here. These are not factual statements here. These are talking points that are way out there sometimes.
Fake news.
Fake news, right. So just because you see an article written from Forbes, written by somebody that's educated, doesn't necessarily make sure it's true.
Right. So let's go through these points here. So the first point, and he just as a broad theme here, the whole premise of the article is he's saying that there's not much difference between organic food and conventional food. You shouldn't buy organic because it's more of a hoopla. Anyway, to his first point, he basically argues that there's no difference in the quality of food in conventionally grown food versus organic food. And I think that's one of the biggest misstatements in his article, and we can look out the window here and tell you exactly why there's a big difference in it. If you look at the cabbage or any of the brassicas they grow right here in South GA, they're pumped full of nitrogen, and you go buy them at the store and cook them up, I give you a 95% chance it's going to tear your belly up come that evening. But if you go eat some of my collards out of my garden, you're going to feel like a champ.
And this is his opinion. And when he states this, he states it as a fact, and it's actually not a fact. It's his opinion, which he has a right to his opinion. But I just wish he would have stated that as his opinion versus a fact.
He might not be able to tell any difference in the taste.
Right.
But I can guarantee you that what the fertilizer inputs that they use versus what organic farmers use are a lot different, and it does affect the taste, mostly with greens. I won't say it will affect the taste of everything. There might be some things you can't tell a difference.
Right.
But with brassicas and things that are big nitrogen feeders, you can certainly tell a difference.
Yep.
Okay, let's go to number two, which I know you want to harp on a little bit.
Woo.
You ready?
I'm ready.
So number two, he writes a whole paragraph basically explaining that conventional pesticides are really, they're no worse than organic pesticides, and they're non-toxic to humans because they've been approved by the EPA and all this stuff.
Yeah, I believe his exact wording was they were non-toxic to humans.
Uh-huh.
Whew. Boy, I tell you what, let him drink him a glass full of bifenthrin and see if he makes the next birthday.
Yeah.
I mean, these chemicals were meant to kill. That's why they was developed for to kill insects or funguses, whatever. When you see the side on the back of pesticide, insecticide, fungicide, any of those, that means to kill. Now, the flip side of this is that we got organic compounds back there that we sell for organic farmers. You don't want to drink those either.
Mm-mm.
So, you know, any of these pesticides are meant to kill, and you want to take them and understand that they can be toxic, and you don't want to drink them. Now, these different levels of how toxic they are, but any of these chemicals that we use to kill insects, you want to treat them with respect, and you do not want to be just drinking them and telling people that they're non-toxic, because that is as far from the truth as you can get. Yeah. And then when I read that, I discounted this whole article at that point when I read that, when he said that they were non-toxic. Relatively, I believe his exact words were relatively non-toxic to humans. Man, that's as far from the truth as you can get.
Right. Yeah, that's, just blows your mind how.
And, you know, there's actually popular people out there that believe that. If you're handling these type compounds, you better believe, you better be careful with them. You better take precautions with them, because they will make you sick, or even that, they'll make you put you in the cemetery pushing up daisies.
That's right. Okay. So, pesticides are definitely toxic.
Pesticides doesn't necessarily mean, when you say pesticides, that doesn't mean it's all conventional. We got pesticides in the organic side, too.
Right, yeah.
And you better treat them with respect also.
That's right, yeah. Number three. He claims just because organic food costs more doesn't mean it's safer. And I think he got off on the wrong foot here, so to say, because it doesn't cost more because it's safer. It costs more because it costs more to produce. On a smaller scale, when you're trying to be good stewards of the land, you're trying to minimize inputs as far as chemicals and things like that, it's going to be a little more labor intensive, and therefore you're going to have more money tied up in what you've done, and that's why it costs more. And you're doing it on a smaller scale. So I don't think people are necessarily making the argument that organic food costs more because it's safer. I think it's basic economics here. It costs more to produce.
Well, from a business standpoint, I think a lot of these big ag companies did their research. The consumer is willing to pay more.
Right.
I mean, the consumer is willing to pay more for organic production than they are for conventional. Just to give you an idea, it was $43 billion of sales in the U.S. of organic products last year. $43 billion.
That's a lot.
Yep. So the consumer is willing to pay more for it. And I think it is well-founded to look at it and try to understand if it's worthwhile or not. You know, when you wrote this article, I would have been a lot more satisfied if he'd said, you know, make informed decisions. Is organic more? Is it, you know, is it different than conventional? And laid out the argument for both sides and let people make the decision. I would love to see that more so than not just damning one side.
We jumped to a few conclusions.
Yeah.
Okay, so number four, and this is a big one for me. He claims that conventional farming requires less land for the same amount of food, and that it is more eco-friendly than organic farming.
Yeah, that's far from the truth. Organic farming in its early development was based off carbon inputs and feeding the soil and create a great soil ecosystem.
Micro environment
to produce these vegetables. Now, if you go back and you understand how organic started, it started up in the northeastern United States. Mm-hmm. And it is, and to be fair, it's a lot easier to practice it up there than it is down south. And it started back in the 60s and the 70s and in the 80s. And around 1990s, when the government got a hold to it, and the government set these standards of what you could label organic and what your inputs had to be and all that, before the 1990, you could do whatever you wanted to. As far as organic, there was no rules or regulations out there. But when the government got a hold to it in the 90s, they set standards on this thing and told us what we had to do and all that. So it's evolved into that. But in its initial conception, it meant building the soil. Since then, it has been, since the government got a hold to it, they have laid it out and it's gotten bigger. And now hydroponics
are included into it.
It has nothing to do with soil. So it is evolved entirely. Big Ag has got involved in it. Mm-hmm. It's evolved a lot since back in the day of the way it was originally developed.
And some of the things that are approved for organic, I'm not a huge fan of using.
No, I mean, you can use bleach in organic production as a disinfectant.
Right.
And bleach is highly toxic.
Right. My big thing with the eco-friendly, and this is a personal example I have. So around here, some of the cotton and peanut farmers have started over the last 5 or 6 years. You'll see some of them, not all of them, using rye cover crops in the winter. And then when it comes close to planting time, what they'll do is they don't till it in the soil or incorporate it. They take an airplane, they spray the whole field with Roundup, and then they come in there with a no-till planter and plant their cotton and peanuts on top of it. And I was asking a guy I knew, big farmer, I said, so why do y'all not incorporate that into the soil instead of killing it off so you can build your soils, build your organic matter, maybe less fertilizer inputs? And he told me point blank, we're not interested in building soils. He said the only thing they're interested in was preventing pigweed growth. And if they don't break that soil, they don't have any pigweed problems. So I thought that was just a glaring example, which completely contradicts what this guy says. And we see it all the time around here. Nothing they do is designed to build the soils.
Well, and you can understand this why. Most of them rent farmland. And when you rent farmland, you're not guaranteed you're going to have it 5 years down the line. You're guaranteed you're going to have it that year. So they're looking to farm that year and get what they can off that year. And they're not looking at a long term because it's rented land. And they don't know what they don't know what the history is going to be. They could lose it next year or the year after. So for them to put inputs in on that rented land is basically just throwing money away from their standpoint, from a business standpoint.
Right.
And that's the way our farming agriculture has evolved. There's a lot of rented land going on out there. And these guys that's farming, they have to look at it from a business standpoint because farming is a business. And they got to look at it from what they can get off of that year. They have no, it doesn't benefit them to build up that farm, to build that soil up from a long-term standpoint.
Right. So,
and most organic farmers is the other way around. It's a long-term type deal where you own the farm, where you got a long-term lease on the farm, and you're looking at years down the road of building a healthy ecosystem to produce so that your inputs won't be as much later on down the line.
And to add to that, most of your organic farmers are growing a much more wide diversity of crops, so they have a wider rotation, whereas around here, it's usually a 2, maybe 3 crop rotation, if that.
Mm-hmm.
So I strongly disagree that it's more eco-friendly.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
And then the last one here, we have disagreed with the author of this article somewhat up to this point, but his last point, he might have a point. So his last point was that the marketing of organic products is unethical and fear-based. And I'm not going to completely disagree with him there.
Well, I'm not either. Big Ag seen something here a few years ago when they seen, and we've seen a tremendous growth in the organic market out there in the grocery stores. If you don't think so, when you go to the grocery store, you're going to see a lot of organic produce in there. And I can promise you 20 years ago, you didn't see that in there. So the market is growing. You know, we got 22,000 organic operations in the U.S. today that are certified. 22,000. All right, so there was $43 billion in sales of organic products last year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, they're getting it. They understand it, that there's a market out there. They want to go in there, and they want to capitalize on this market here. Over 100 million of those organic products came from Mexico. So we know that's Big Ag.
Mm-hmm.
So Big Ag has got in there. Is there some fraud in some of these certifications or some of this organic production going on there? Probably so. When you got that much money out there, there probably is some fraud, and there probably is some issues out there that you wouldn't be feel real comfortable with paying more for a product and knowing what's going on with it. Here's the takeaway for me. As we said earlier, make informed decisions. Understand both sides of the aisle, the way things are produced and the way things are certified, and make informed decisions. The very best thing you can do is know where your food comes from.
Exactly. Know where it comes from. And I do think it's kind of like the whole non-GMO, gluten-free thing. I think some things are exploited as far as the marketing of organic products. But understand what you're buying. Understand what you're eating. And as we always say, the best way to know what's in your food,
grow it yourself.
That's right. It's to grow it yourself.
And if you can't grow it yourself, and I know we all hold down jobs and we can't grow all our food, at least know where it comes from. I mean, when you can, buy from that small farmer. Buy from that people that you can actually...
Farmer's market.
Yeah. Farmer's market that you can ask what inputs to use neonicotinoids. Because neonicotinoids is a big thing for me. You mentioned nitrogen is a big thing for you. Well, the neonicotinoids is huge for me. Ask that farmer, you know, to use neonicotinoids. Things that is a big concern of you, you can ask those questions of how that food was grown, and you can get an idea, and you can feel better about it. And there, you're making informed decisions.
That's right. I hope everyone enjoyed that discussion there. Please go take a look, read that article. It's not too long. Take a few minutes.
And if you disagree with us, comment on us and let's have that conversation. We'd be love to hear about what you think.
Yeah, or if you have any additional points for or against anything we said, we would love to hear it. It's all about facilitative discussion here to all become more educated.
And what it comes back down to me is facts. Regardless of what you think, let's back it up with facts.
That's right. Okay, let's get into some questions from last week's show. And the first question we have here is from G. Barnes, 1982. And he says, thanks for the information y'all provide. I tried some of your corn seeds this year, direct sown, and they've done great so far. I do want to ask about side dressing your corn plants. He says he doesn't use drip irrigation currently.
Yeah, we used to side dress all the time. I still do some. I side dressed just last week, which lay a nitrate. And I lay it about the A far away from my plant, and I got this old school fertilizer distributor I can pull. But you can take a cup and do the same thing. Try to get it as even possible and lay it down about 3 inches from that corn plant, and then I'll go back and I'll heel to it and cover up. Now, this is the way I like to do it if I'm on side dress. I like to side dress one time with a balanced fertilizer such as 10-10-10 or a 15-15-15, whatever. Then I like to come back and alternate that with just a nitrogen source. And I'm using Chilean nitrate. You know, I'll also use some other, ammonia nitrate. You can use ammonia nitrate. Anything where you get straight nitrogen, because corn's a big lover of nitrogen. I do it 2 to 3 times if I'm not injected in there. I do a pre-plant fertilization, and then I'll do it, I'll probably side dress anywhere from 2 to 3 times according to what it's looking like.
Yeah, I like to put it down before I heel as well, yeah. When they get about a foot and a half tall.
Right, when you heel it and cover it with that fertilizer, it makes it a little more stable.
Yeah, it gives you some nice slow release. And once you get a little rain or something, boy,
boom, boom,
gone.
We had a rain, as I mentioned, we had a rain Sunday. As soon as the rain was over with, I went straight to the garden. And I can promise you, when I got up here, it looked like my corn had grown.
We needed it. Okay, what we got for our second question there?
All right. Steven Stovall says, great show, and as always, enjoy all the tips. Question, I have is, how do you know when to stop healing potatoes?
Okay, so this is an interesting point because I've kind of tested this in my garden a little bit over the years, because I'll see some people that get to make their potato hills this tall with a tractor, and then some like you, yours never get more than about a foot and a half tall. And I've kind of tested this, and there is what I like to call a law of diminishing returns, where you're just doing a lot more work and you're not getting that many more taters by healing them that tall. So I've done some research on this, and I've heard a little bit about this before, but really dug into it. So just like with potatoes, well, you have determinate and indeterminate potato varieties. Now, they're not the determinate or indeterminate nature doesn't seem as well defined as it does with tomatoes, but there are those categories. Usually your earlier potatoes, your early season potatoes are going to be determinate. And you'll see even some websites that say that you don't need to heal those at all. Now, we like to heal them because it keeps them from being exposed to the sun, also helps with weed control, stabilizing the plant. Now, your late season potatoes, like your German butterball, for instance, are indeterminate. You might have seen some YouTube videos out there of people growing these in pallets or these potato towers where they just keep adding dirt and dirt and dirt, and they pull up this long string of potatoes. That only works with those indeterminate late season varieties. You couldn't do that with a red potato or early potato.
Really?
So, for the... like the Yukon Gold, the red, the fingerling, even the blue potato. Early to mid stuff, I would heal them, you know, a foot and a half tall. Let those plants grow, be done with. It's not going to do you much good to keep healing them any higher than that. With the late variety, like the German butterball, you can. Now, I'm not going to, because I ain't got a way to get my dirt that tall, but you can keep healing those, and supposedly they will keep growing clusters along that main stem.
So you could, if you had them in a what we call potato things, you
a
could,
tower.
When they make potatoes, if you add, they continue to make them again and again and again and again.
Yeah. If you had like a piece of fence turned like some makeshift tomato cage, you can do that with those.
But you have to use the correct variety.
Yeah, you can't do it with all the varieties. You have to use one of those late season varieties.
Good information. I did not know that.
So, I would just, you know, heal them a little bit. No sense in working yourself to death trying to heal potatoes real tall, because a lot of times I found it doesn't make a big difference.
Yep.
All right. So, hope y'all enjoyed our 50th episode there. Leave us some questions if you have any, or some comments. We'd love to hear from you guys. Hit that subscribe button, hit that share button. We will see you guys on next week's
show. Take care.